On Monday, July 13th at 7 p.m., the Irish Repertory Theatre presents Frank McCourt's The Irish and How They Got That Way, an evening of music, story and song. Please reserve your tickets at www.irishrep.org.
Monday, June 9th, 1930, Chicago, Illinois. At the Randolph and Michigan Avenue train station, 38-year-old Jake Lingle, a crime reporter for the Chicago Tribune, is smoking a cigar and reading the newspaper as he waits for the departing train on the platform.
1:30 p.m. train to Washington Park Racetrack will be arriving in 5 minutes.
Hey, Lingo.
Who's asking?
The newspaper was still clutched in Lingle's hands, and the cigar was still in his mouth as his blood seeped out of the back of his head onto the train platform. The public whacking of Jake Lingle sent shockwaves of anger and disgust through the streets of the Windy City that reverberated down into Chicago's underworld, all the way to Scarface Al Capone. The newspapers around town rallied and called for justice for Jake Lingle. At the time, the unspoken rule with the underworld was that newspaper men were off limits. However, there is more than meets the eye to this front page headline. Let's solve the mystery of who killed Al Capone's paperboy. They say you cannot escape history, but through the ages, some stories have slipped through the cracks. Join me as we thumb through the pages of the past. Tales of crime, passion, and murder. Stories from history without an ending, at least not yet. These are the mysteries from the past. The Roaring Twenties might have just ended, but the party is still continuing into the 1930s, as Prohibition is still law of the land. The idea that banning alcohol would make America more peaceful, well, they were dead wrong, as Prohibition gave rise to government agent corruption, inner city violence, and especially the rise of organized crime in the mafia. There were a few exceptions to the law, however. For one, church attendance increased tenfold, as a lot of Catholics suddenly found God during the 1920s while drinking the blood of Christ on Sunday mornings. As Prohibition removed government structure and oversight over the selling and distribution of alcohol, it provided an opening for organized crime to step in. The mob would make and distribute alcohol throughout the United States, as well as pay off local cops and prohibition agents known as prohies.
You didn't see anything.
The mob now ran America's cities. Chicago would become the country's center of gangland violence. Over 729 homicides occurred in Cook County alone during the 1920s, and it didn't look as though the 1930s was going to be any different, as the times remained fast and the dames faster. William Big Bill Hale Thompson might have been the mayor of Chicago in 1930, but its true leader was Al Capone. History knows him as Scarface. We will return to Capone later, but first, it's time to put Jake Lingle on the front page. Jake Lingle grew up in the rough and tumble neighborhood of Chicago's West Side at the turn of the 20th century. A hustler, his smarts came from the streets, not from school. Lingle had, at most, an eighth grade education. His childhood best friend, William F. Russell, would later become the chief of police in Chicago when Lingo followed the hazardous calling of a crime reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Let's start on the day that Lingo was put to sleep in broad daylight. Monday, June 9th, 1930, was a typical summer day in Chicago. A little humid, and of course, a little windy. Crime reporter Jake Lingo buys a newspaper at a paper stand.
Those Brooklyn Robins gave the Cubs a real whacking last night.
Maybe next year for the Cubbies.
Not this century.
A cab pulls up alongside of Lingo.
Hey, Lingo. Play High Schneider in the third.
I got him.
After speaking to a cabbie about the upcoming races, Lingle descends the pedestrian stairs to the Randolph and Michigan subway station to catch the train to the racetrack. After hitting the racetrack, Lingle planned on going to the Sheridan Wave Tournament Club, a gambling joint at 621 Waveland Avenue that was reopening that night. As Lingle made his way down the stairs to the train platform, two well-dressed men flanked the crime reporter. One had blonde hair, wore a straw boater, and a gray suit. The other was in a dark blue suit.
The 1:30 p.m. train to Washington Park Racetrack will be arriving in 5 minutes.
On the platform, Lingle read about the ponies holding the newspaper and smoking a cigar as the blonde man approached Lingle.
Hey, Lingo.
Who's asking?
After shooting Lingle in the head with a .38, the blonde man threw the gun away and ran forward into the crowd.
Stop that man! Stop
him! Help
somebody, please!
Is anyone a doctor?
Help!
Ah.
I need a doctor!
Somebody
here, doctor!
Murder!
Unable to escape through the large chaotic crowd running from the gunshot, the blonde man doubles back past Lingle's dead body and escapes out the eastern staircase as he is pursued by a policeman.
Police! I order you to halt!
Running up Randolph Street, pursued by the beat cop, the blonde man removes a silk glove from his firing hand, presumably warned to leave no fingerprints on the gun, and throws it into the street before disappearing into the crowd of pedestrians on Wabash Avenue as Patrick Campbell chases the dark-haired man in the blue suit on the platform.
Stop that man! He just shot someone!
What's the matter, my son?
Out of nowhere, a priest intercepts Patrick Campbell.
I think someone has been shot by that man.
Someone was shot? I'm getting out of here.
Because the priest cut him off, Patrick Campbell lost sight of the dark-haired accomplice in the throng of people leaving the crime scene as Jake Lingle's lifeless body laid face down on the train platform. Jake Lingle is dead. Later that evening, proprietor of the Chicago Tribune, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, breaks the news to his staff.
Boys, stop what you're working on. One of our reporters, hold on a second.
McCormick searches for the piece of paper with Lingle's name on it.
Jake Lingle was killed earlier today by gangland hitmen at the Randolph and Michigan subway station at around 1:30 p.m. for doing his job. Jake was a married man and had two young children. That's 12 murders in 10 days, fellas. Something has to change in this town. The Tribune will solve this crime. Next morning's headline will read, Tribune reporter Jake Lingle slain by gunmen. The Tribune is offering $25,000 as a reward for information which will lead to the conviction of the slayer or slayers. Solve this case, boys. Do it for Jake. Now get to it.
The town of Chicago is completely shocked by the killing of a newspaper man. Anger and disgust at the mafia is heard on every street corner. Around town, the newspapers would organize in an attempt to bring justice to the murderer who killed one of their own. The Chicago Evening Post would add $5,000 to the reward, followed by another $25,000 from the Hearst, Chicago Herald and Examiner, bringing the total reward for information on Jake Lingle's killer to $55,000. A pretty large sum for a reporter whose name his boss needed to read off a piece of paper. At police headquarters, Chief Investigator Patrick Roach questions eyewitness Patrick Campbell on what he saw on the platform that June 9th. Tell me what you saw, Mr. Campbell.
I saw the man who was shot coming along, with one man on each side of him.
Then what happened?
One of the men stopped at the newsstand and bought a paper, lagging behind an instant. Then I passed them all, and a second later, I heard a shot.
What did you do then?
Chased after the dark-haired man who was intercepted by a priest who stepped in front of me and asked me what had just happened.
A priest, huh?
Yeah. After I told him what had just happened, the priest said, I'm getting out of here.
Interesting. Mr. Campbell, it is my belief that that man was no priest.
Why do you say that, detective?
Because a priest would never do that. He would have gone to the side of the stricken person. This was a calculated hit, Mr. Campbell. Jake Lingle walked into a trap.
June 11, 1930. The Tribune, the challenge. The meaning of this murder is plain. It was committed in reprisal and an attempt at intimidation. Mr. Lingle was a police reporter and an exceptionally well-informed one. What made him valuable to his newspaper marked him as dangerous to his killers. It is war. There will be casualties, but that is to be expected, it being war.
This is Police Commissioner Ruff. I have given orders to the five deputy police commissioners to make this town so quiet that you will be able to hear a consumptive canary cough.
Lingle is given a state funeral worthy of a fallen president as Chicago's police went to the mattresses with the mob when Chief Investigator Patrick Roach catches a break in the case.
Excuse me, Detective Roach. The results came back on the 38 that killed Lingle. What do you got, officer? The serial number on the 38 had been filed down, but forensics was able to recover it. And we traced the weapon to a sporting goods dealership on Diversey Parkway, owned by Peter Von Francius. Von Francius supplied the weapons to Scarface Capone for the St. Valentine's Day massacre. Bingo, Chief. This gun was sold to Frank Foster from the Northside Gang. Good work, officer. Why don't we put Frank Foster on the box?
The police have their first major suspect in the case in Frankie Foster, also known as Frost. Foster was of Romanian Jewish heritage and was part of the Irish Northside Gang run by Dean O'Banion, who in 1925, unsuccessfully, tried to take out Al Capone at a Chicago Southside restaurant.
Frankie Foster, where were you on the afternoon of June 9th?
You're trying to pin the Lingle murder on me, huh, Roach? Well, it won't stick.
Just asking questions here.
You got nothing.
We traced the gun left at the scene to you, Foster. Want to tell us about that?
Guns switch hands all the time in this town. You know that, Roach. Might have sold it for a few dollars years ago. I will tell you this, though. Lingle isn't who you think he is.
What are you getting at, Foster?
You coppers don't know nothing. Lingle was on the take. He was as crooked as they come. How many reporters do you know wear diamond-studded belts? I'd like my phone call now.
Foster is later brought before several eyewitnesses, including Patrick Campbell and Officer Ruthie, who chased the shooter. And they say that Foster was not the man they saw at the scene. The state attorney, convinced that Foster was not their man, let him go free. But his information on Lingle being crooked needed to be followed up. Roach makes his way to the Chicago Tribune to question Lingle's boss, Robert McCormick.
Come in, Detective Roach. Have a seat. What can I help you with?
Can you tell me about Jake Lingle as an employee?
Well, to be honest, I never met him.
He worked here for 18 years. You never met him?
Never even heard of him until his death.
I see. How many stories did he break or write?
None. Never had one byline in the Tribune. Lingle was a leg man, you see. He gathered information at the scene of a crime or from sources. He then phoned them into a reporter to write the scoop. He was known around town by cops and crooks.
What was his weekly pay from the Tribune?
Leg men usually make around $65 a week.
You're right, Mr. McCormick. You don't know Jake Lingle.
Excuse me?
Lingle had on his person $9,000 in his pocket when he was killed, and he was wearing a diamond-studded belt that was supposedly given to him as a gift by Scarface Capone. We then checked his bank records. At the time of his death, Lingle had $60,000 in the bank. You don't get that kind of dough on $65 a week. Mr. McCormick, Jake Lingle is not the martyred reporter we thought he was. The revelation that Jake Lingle isn't the noble reporter who was killed doing his job stunned the city of Chicago. $9,000 in 1930 is a lot of money, especially at the beginning of the Great Depression. Adjusted for inflation, that's $138,000 in today's money. And that $60,000 in the bank? Well, let's just say Jake Lingle is the only millionaire to acquire that much money on a $65 a week salary. So who was Jake Lingle? And why is Al Capone giving him diamond-studded belts? Back at police headquarters, Detective Roach is poring over the evidence with State Attorney John A. Swanson. Let's go over one more time what we know. Lingle made a fortune operating between the two worlds, the legit world and the underworld. Through his connections with city officials, cops, and judges, Lingle provided information and protection to mafia bosses such as Al Capone. Capone would pay Lingle to make sure the authorities looked the other way. There's even a rumor around town that it was Lingle who set the price for beer in Chicago.
What about the silk glove left at the scene?
Good question, Swanson. We think that the glove belongs to our blonde slayer, who was a right-hand shot. I'm positive Lingle was not killed for doing his job. He was leading a dual life. He had a house in Long Beach and a chauffeur, and I wonder who that could be. Come in. Afternoon, Attorney Paquette. How can I help you?
I have some information on Lingle.
Really? What do you got?
I saw Lingle the day before he was killed in the loop.
Attorney Paquette, what do you do? What do you say?
Afternoon, Lingle. Lingle gave me his theory of who killed Red McLaughlin when a blue sedan pulled up alongside us. When Lingle noticed the sedan, he stopped mid-sentence.
Red McLaughlin was killed and left in the canal by...
Jesus.
I'm being tailed. Goodbye.
So Lingle knew he was in trouble. Did you recognize the men in the sedan?
I did. They were members of Scarface Capone's gang.
Let's go pay a visit to Scarface Capone.
Detective Roach goes to the Eschecker restaurant, a speakeasy owned by Al Capone, to have a sit-down with the mafia leader.
Detective Roach, why do I owe the pleasure?
Got a few questions about Lingle.
Ask away. Would you like a drink?
Excuse me?
Just a little joke. Yeah. Why do you want to know?
Was Jake your friend?
Yes. Up to the very day he died. May he rest in peace.
Did you have a row with him?
Absolutely not.
If you did not have a row with Lingle, why did you refuse to see him upon your release from the workhouse in Philadelphia?
Who said I didn't see him?
The Chicago newspapers?
Well, if Jake failed to say I didn't see him, then I didn't see him.
Word on the street is you gave Lingle the diamond-studded belt he was wearing the day he was killed.
Yeah, that's right. Christmas gift for a dear friend of mine.
Have a good day, Mr. Capone.
Oh, one last thing, Detective. The Chicago police know who killed Lingle. Take a look at Leo Brothers. You might find something.
On the tip from Al Capone on Leo Brothers, who bore a very close resemblance to the witness description, Leo Brothers is put on trial for the murder of Jake Lingle. Leo V. Brothers was a member of Egan's Rats, a gang which was a Capone affiliate. He was a labor union slugger. At his arraignment, Brothers refused to plead either guilty or innocent, instead only saying,
"On the advice of my attorneys, I stand mute."
The prosecution produced 7 eyewitnesses who fingered Leo Brothers as the shooter. However, the defense pointed out that a number of these witnesses were on the payroll of the state's attorney, and that their description to police at the time of the murder differed in several important details. Yet Judge Joseph Sabbath rendered his decision.
Will the defendant, Mr. Leo Brothers, please rise? Mr. Brothers, the jury finds you guilty of murdering Alfred Jake Lingle. You are hereby sentenced to 14 years in a state penitentiary.
In the end, the prosecution's witnesses were more believable to the jurors, and Brothers' checkered past in St. Louis made him a plausible assassin. At sentencing, Brothers proudly told reporters,
I can do that standing on my head.
Looks like case closed on who killed Al Capone's paperboy. Or is it? Many believed that behind the scenes, former attorney Paquette, who saw Lingle the day before his death, or some wealthy supporter, someone like Al Capone, had paid off the dissenting jurors, and that Leo Brothers was a fall guy for the real murderer. According to eyewitnesses, such as Patrick Campbell, the assassin had either fair hair or blonde hair and was a right-hand shot. No fingerprints were found on the gun because the assassin wore a silk glove over his hand. We know that Lingle was a terrible reporter and more corrupt than your average gangster, since Lingle knowingly posed as a moral and upright citizen as he played the underworld off the legit world. Lingle knew he was being tailed when he met Attorney Paquette the day before he was murdered. Who has the power to pay off jurors, have a fall guy in Leo Brothers at the snap of their finger, and had a personal and business relationship with Lingle. None other than the true leader of Chicago, Scarface Al Capone. We know that Capone knew Lingle and had bought him the diamond-studded belt as a gift. We also know that Lingle had a business deal with Capone that he did not deliver on. Here's what we think. Late one evening, Lingle goes to the Exchequer restaurant to see Al Capone and gets into a heated argument days before he is murdered over political protection Lingle was supposed to provide for the Mafia Don.
Jake, you were paid 50 G's to secure protection from your old childhood buddy, Police Commissioner Russell, for a West Side dog track. That protection did not come to fruition. Where's my money? Did you keep it, Lingle?
You got it all wrong, Capone. You got it all wrong. I didn't keep the money. I used it to get you a cut in the Sheridan Wave Tournament Club.
That's Bugs Moran's turf. You double-crossing me, Lingle?
No. Never. I swear. I swear on my children.
Yeah, word on the street is you took the 50G and gambled it on stocks. Now you're in trouble with the IRS. You talking to the IRS about me?
The IRS? No. Never. I swear. I swear.
Lingle, stop weeping like a woman. Have a drink. I trust you, Jake. We are old friends. Who gave you the diamond belt?
You did, boss.
Tell me, what day does the Sheridan Wave Club open?
June 9th.
Monday, the 9th? Okay, Jake. Don't worry. Go home and get some rest. Sam, come here. I want you to take out Lingle. He's been bumping gums with the IRS, and since he isn't Sicilian, he does not hold himself to the code of silence. We need to silence him out before he yaps the feds. On Mondays, Lingle goes to the horse track to bet. Hit him out on the subway platform. The code will be play by Schneider in the third. When you hear that, move in. Capiche?
Capiche, boss.
Hey, Lingle. Play High Schneider in the third.
I got him.
Scarface Al Capone had Jake Lingle whacked by button man Sam Hunt because Lingle was given information to the IRS about Capone to ease his financial troubles. Witnesses later recognized Sam Hunt, a known Capone hitman, at the Randolph and Michigan Avenue train station on Monday, June the 9th, the day Lingle was killed. But wait. We know that from Lingle's job as a crime reporter that he knew most of the gangsters in town. We also know that Lingle was as crooked as a dog's hind leg. A week before his death, Lingle went into business with Jack Zuda from the Northsiders to open a dog track on the west side, the same track he was working with Capone on. Lingle promised that for $2,500, he could get it opened with no pressure from the cops. Instead, Lingle took the money from Zuda. Angry at being duped, Zuda put a price on Lingle's head.
Patsy, come here.
Yeah, boss?
I want you to give Lingle the big sleep. Follow him and kill him. I don't care when, and I don't care how. I just want him dead. Do it public if you have to.
You sure about this, boss? Lingle is close with Capone.
I'll deal with Capone.
It was Pasqualino Patsy Tardi, not Sam Hunt, who was the man on the platform June 9th who killed Jake Lingle. As for the silk glove, it was known around town that Tardi, was a sharp dresser. Could it be that Tardy was the blonde-haired man, and Sam Hunt was the dark-haired man who was keeping an eye on Lingle for Capone? When Capone heard that Jake Lingle had been bumped off by Patsy Tardy, Capone got his revenge. On January 6th, 1931, two men lured Tardy out of his house.
No, please, please, not in the face, not in the face.
Capone sends his regards.
Maybe Lingle and Capone were friends after all. Jake Lingle's death rocked the city of Chicago. First as outrage and then as scandal that reached from the corridors of City Hall to the dark alleyways of Chicago's underworld. What happened to our suspects? Frank Foster, whose gun was used to kill Lingle, left Chicago and went to California, where he became involved in gambling. Foster would die in 1960. Leo Vincent Brothers, the fall guy who served 14 years for the murder, survived an assassination attempt in 1950 when he was shot by a gunman in the neck. That December, Brothers died of heart disease. The only man convicted of killing Lingle rests in Oak Hill Cemetery in Kirkwood, Missouri. Al Capone, the original Teflon Don, was never charged with the murder of Jake Lingle. Although no one knows to this day what his involvement in the murder was. In 1931, Capone was sentenced to 11 years in prison for tax evasion by the IRS. In prison, he was diagnosed with syphilis. His health would decline and he would die at the age of 48 in Palm Island, Florida. In 1933, newly elected President Franklin Delano Roosevelt would repeal prohibition with the 21st Amendment, ending the mafia's stranglehold on America's cities. And as for Jake Lingle, after giving a state funeral before his underworld's connection were divulged to the public, he was laid to rest in Mount Carmel Catholic Cemetery Hillside in Cook County, Illinois. And his true killer has never been brought to justice. Who do you think killed Jake Lingle? Al Capone's paperboy. Mysteries from the Past is brought to you by Macy Duffy Productions. This episode was written and narrated by Rory Duffy. The cast included Kieran O'Reilly, Adam Petherbridge, Mick Malanfi, Harry Smith, John Keating, Angelita Esperanza, Rory Duffy, and Eric Svensson. Original music and sound design by Rory Duffy. If you enjoy our show and want to hear more, please consider donating to our Patreon page at Mysteries from the Past. You can also follow the show on Instagram at Mysteries from the Past. Thank you for tuning in.